Hello and welcome to HIV Matters podcast. My name is Michelle Croston, and as your host, I will be facilitating interesting conversations with leading experts in the field of HIV care. The conversations will be centred around exploring ways to improve quality of life for people living with HIV. Throughout my career, I've always had a keen interest in any initiatives to improve outcomes for people living with HIV, which has led me to work with a variety of different organisations, with different healthcare professionals and activists. Here at HIV Matters, we hope to use our unique perspectives and platforms to improve knowledge and understanding with regards to HIV. In order to do this, we will engage in conversations with people living with HIV, people who have worked in the HIV sector, and sometimes a mixture of both. We hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have any ideas or questions on this or future episodes, please contact us at hello@hivmatters.co.uk. You can also follow us on Instagram at HIV Matters Podcast, or visit our website at www.hivmatterspodcast.co.uk. Don't forget to subscribe, rate and comment on our show. Today I'm being joined on the HIV Matters podcast by Ian Jackson, who's kind of going to introduce himself in a little minute. But before that, I'm delighted to be able to share this podcast space with the HIV Matters First. So my co-host for today is Angelina Nambier. So I'm super excited to be speaking to Ian and also to be sharing this time with Angelina. So thank you, Angelina, for agreeing to come on and co-host with me.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
So Ian, thank you so much for agreeing to come on to the podcast. I'm just wondering, are you able to introduce yourself to our podcast listeners, please?
Yeah, of course. Thank you for inviting me. So I'm Ian Jackson. I'm the Director of Contracts and Planning for NHS London's Specialised Commissioning Unit in my day job. But I also do a lot of work on HIV. So primarily that is as part of the Fast Track Cities Initiative Leadership Group for London. But also I run a programme in London and I'm now advising nationally on the rollout of opt-out testing in emergency departments, which is a change to our processes. And separately from that, I'm also a trustee of Rethink Mental Illness. So that kind of keeps me quite busy as well.
So thank you very much, Ian. So my turn now. So my question is, well, can you just tell us what your motivation is for working in this sector? So no, why do you do the work that you do?
It's an interesting question. I found the sector, I mean, I've always known about the sector, but in the life of a kind of healthcare administrator, which is as exciting as it sounds quite a lot of the time, you look for the things that really kind of spark some level of passion in you to do the right thing. And it's so clear in HIV that actually, you know, I'm fond of saying that HIV is never really about HIV at all. It's about social justice. It's about LGBTQ plus rights. It's about minoritized communities of all types, and comes from a place of horror. But is very much in a kind of space of hope now. So something that has, you know, killed 40 million people and nobody ever has to die anymore, and we can be part of a generation that stops everyone dying, and actually with the right focus, we could get to an eradication without a vaccine of, you know, onward transmission. We could really get to zero. The start of that is having seen, I think it was 6 years ago now, I saw Bikita Kasada do a poem at an event for the King's Fund. And I won't repeat the poem because I can't do it justice, but the subtext of it was for people, you know, there are about probably 200 people in the room. Mm. And the subtext was, and she said this on the day, which is, you know, the people you call hard to reach, I see them every day and you never leave your office. And it was one of those moments where I felt like someone was talking directly to me, mm-hmm. personally, and something went off. And at the same time, I've been doing various kind of bits of study and working out what I wanted to do. And I thought, I can't in good conscience do nothing about this. I think I've got, you know, I'm a one of a team of people who looks after £6 billion worth of the NHS budget, which is a huge amount of money. I mean, that is all committed, and that's what pays for lots of hospital activities. So it's not like we have discretion with it. But I kind of embarked on this thing of not believing that we didn't have any discretion over any of it, and that we couldn't try something a bit different. But that was really the spark for me that started me working in the sector. And interestingly, the longer and longer I've worked in the sector, the more attached to it I've become, and the more joy and the more fire that I felt to do something about HIV in a way that I have found with some other things, but that there is a simplicity to HIV, which is that the medication, in my view, that, you know, HIV meds are the greatest medical innovation since the polio vaccine. And the meds work, U equals U works, you know, all of it is, from a medical point of view, really actually quite straightforward. Mm-hmm. But there are still people who don't medicate, and there are still people who we can't get to offer help to. And I find that such an interesting philosophical point about, well, actually, the thing that is now ailing you is not necessarily the HIV, it's your societal circumstance. Mm-hmm. And if we can get to working out how we do something about that, then we can learn lessons for every single other specialty we work on. So I think HIV is the cornerstone. And again, the more I work in it, the more I think it's the cornerstone of how we should do all of medicine and all of care for people, because it shows us so much and we learn so much all the time.
Thank you very much. And I absolutely hear you. I'm going to hand you over to Michelle to ask you the next set of questions.
Thank you so much for sharing that insight with us, Ian. You mentioned as part of the work, you're involved in Fast Track Cities. Now, this is something that's come up on the podcast a few times, but I'm just wondering, for our listeners, if you could just explain a little bit more about what it means to be part of Fast Track Cities.
So it's Fast Track Cities is a kind of brand, I guess. It's a global initiative with the idea of helping municipalities and cities get to zero. It started 10 years ago, started in 2014, I believe. We didn't sign up till 2018. And we signed up partly because we have wonderful Professor Jane Anderson, who wanted to sign up, and I met Jane and we had a very, very long conversation about it. But the idea for London, what we could make it for London, and I can't speak to, you know, all the other cities who have their own ways of working in the Fast Track Cities network, but for London, it seemed like a really good way to focus everyone's attention and sort of sign a document to say, at the time it was Public Health England, the Mayor of London's office, the London Councils and NHS England would all sign a bit of paper committing to eradicate HIV. And this kind of struck me as the way we were supposed to be working for lots of things, but actually weren't doing that all that often. And there was something about the overt commitment of saying, no, we really want to do this, aligned with the fact that our numbers for London have always been very, very good on a kind of international scale. So there was something about making a big fuss about that. People didn't know that we were against the 90-90-90 numbers, and then which became 95-95-95 numbers. We were doing as well as any global city in the world, and probably better. Any city in the world. There was something about, well, we really could be the first city to eradicate. To eradicate for London, with 9 million people in it, and a lot of movement around the city, would be such an achievement. It's kind of, again, it's one of those fundamental questions about why wouldn't you want to be part of that? And for us, it enabled us to almost slightly democratize the response. So it brought everyone together in the response, but also it allows us all to sit around a table. And don't get me wrong, you know, there are lots of partners and lots of different thoughts on how why we should do various things, but it also gave us a focus to allow, from my point of view, some funding to be released from the NHS. And there was a kind of interesting point within the early days of it. So we've got Professor Kevin Fenton as the other co-chair of it for us. So we've got these, you know, two amazing chairs. Mm-hmm. And we were sat there in the very early days before we got any funding, thinking, well, this thing is a great idea, but it needs some money to become a viable thing, I think, for us to be able to do something with it more than just talk about it. And I had some ideas about how we'd work directly with the charity sector, because it was clear that there was a massive charity sector. Again, it came out of all those good things. And I'm, again, I have this I have the belief that the charity sector exists because the statutory sector has left a gap for it to exist into. So things emerge, things don't emerge where there's no problem. Mm. And then the statutory services, the NHS included, spends a lot of time not engaging with, you know, where, and looking for answers when sometimes the answers are kind of there, or the power of the answers is are there. And there were so many charities in London working on HIV, but we didn't really have a way to work together. And everyone was sort of fighting for little bits of money here and there. And I thought, well, actually, wouldn't it be great if we could do a multi-year programme? And this was the time where we could do a multi-year programme. So I kind of we got £2 million a year for 3 years as the first wave of funding. It's gone down a little bit since then, but we're still funded now by the NHS. And we took £1 million of that, and we made an improvement collaborative for the charity sector. And each the thing that we did in there that was very unusual for an NHS funding route was that we said that NHS trusts could not be the primary bidders for any services. It had to be the independent sector. Mm-hmm. That didn't mean the NHS trust couldn't work with the independent sector. It just meant that things had to be led. And the reason for that was that we knew, you know, well, one, that they needed the money, but also that the money is more likely to do specifically what happens at source. It doesn't get caught up in all the NHS method of dealing with very, very large amounts of money. So we had 12 projects, and we spanned, I think it was 21 or 22 charities, 9 different NHS organisations, all working towards the same goal. And we brought in the quality improvement methodology, which a lot of the charities didn't thank us for and still probably don't. But actually, it was very deliberate, because we were trying to answer the question, how do we get to zero? And the honest answer is, well, I don't know. I work in an office. Going back to Paquita's point, you know, I can't sort of direct the end of an epidemic from here. I have no idea how we do it. But if we could somehow harness the collective power of everyone who works across the city and go, well, why don't we try some stuff and see if it works? And the quality improvement methodology gave us a way for it to, you're sort of allowed to fail. And being allowed to, when I say allowed to fail, it means try something. If it doesn't work, instead of being defunded, try something else. So you still have to participate in the process. Try something else, see what happens. And you can start to get some amazing results. So we did that with half the money, and then I thought it was important for me as the NHS representative to sort of try and stay out of the way of how we use some of the other funding, and to allow that to be used by the other board members and other interested parties. So we have stigma campaigns. We've just started an ambassadors campaign led by the Terence Higgins Trust. We've got we have everyone sort of in a partnership now, in a way that I think we've helped to bring the sector together a little bit. I like to think we have done that. That's certainly some of the feedback that I've got. And yeah, I'm very proud of that achievement, and I'd like to be able to keep it going.
Thank you so much for that. You just kind of explained kind of some of the key benefits of being part of a fast track city now, more importantly, how this has kind of evolved for London. I'm just wondering, are there any key priorities this year for Fast Track Cities? You've mentioned the Ambassadors Programme. Is there any other priorities our listeners could maybe think about hearing or like listening out for?
Yeah, I mean, we're going out for another Quality Improvement Collaborative. That's so we've just appointed, actually. So we've got some new projects coming in. About half of those are going to be aligned with peer support, and making sure that peer support comes is available as routine. That in London anyways is going to be linked to the peer support that's coming through the opt-out testing program, because we also made some provision for that to happen. So each of the ICBs or integrated care systems, sorry if people are not familiar with that, have sort of pot now in London to be able to employ peer support organizations to help people newly diagnosed, but also who aren't actively receiving care. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite a big commitment. What we need to make sure is that everything is there is a national standard for that, so we want to make sure we get everyone as close to standard as possible. There are loads of things on the Fast Track Cities agenda for the year, and in fact I can't remember them all as a quiz off the top of my head. I usually have a deck of slides in front of me telling me what they are, but the Ambassadors Program is really important. You know, really, really fighting the stigma that exists. We've got our, we're also going to have our hospital anti-stigma campaign coming in as well, to, because we know there's an awful lot of stigma happens within healthcare settings. So making sure that we're at, so there's a program called HIV Confident. So we're making sure that people who are, organisations can sign up to make sure that, you know, all of their staff don't think about HIV like they did in the 80s, which is still kind of slightly pervasive in people's thinking. And there's a I've got a really interesting sort of sidebar point on that, which is that I think, again, we have the best story in healthcare. So, and there's two ways to do things in the NHS. So there are some times where we have to intervene in a way that actually, you know, causes people to be shocked and causes people to act in a slightly different way. So you might do something like that with sickle. My most recent meeting actually, as I'm talking to you today, was on sickle cell. We've had some, you know, really heartbreaking stories and on what's happened to patients living with sickle cell and actually dying with sickle cell. And that kind of forces you into action, which is, we mustn't do this. We must do it. We must do things in a certain way now. We must do A, B, C. I think we have an opportunity that's very different and more compelling in HIV. Not that that's not important, of course it is. But the opportunity we have in HIV is to be able to say, this is the best story. Wouldn't you like to come with us? You know, healthcare is hard at the moment. It's difficult for everyone who's involved in it. But we could be the first place to eradicate, to get to zero, to do something amazing, genuinely amazing within the scope of the work that we do in within our populations. Isn't this a brilliant thing? And every single person in every single department can help us get there. And we can't offer that across lots of other things. So I think there is a very much, you know, this has got to be the, you know, something that people willingly sign up to. And the more and more people I work with, when we approach it like that, the more people are keen to come forward and start to do something and start to help. And we've seen that in opt-out testing as well.
Thank you so much for sharing that. So I guess if our listeners wanted to get involved in that and help, what would the best way to go about that be?
They can contact me directly. They can contact Fast Track City's office. In London, this is there are different Fast Track cities all over the country as well. By the way, so the first thing to do is to check whether they are part of one themselves, I guess. But we know we've got them in, you know, Birmingham, Blackpool, and all over the UK as well. So most places now have a Fast Track Cities site. What I will say is most of the others aren't funded. Certainly they're not funded to the level that London has managed to find funding for. So difficult to know exactly what everyone needs locally, but, you know, please do get in touch with them. We can put some links in the show notes if that's helpful, and get some email addresses. But yeah, I'm very, very happy to be contacted myself if that's helpful.
Thank you so much for that, Ian. So we will drop some links into the show notes, and yeah, the Fast Track City website as well. We can pop into the show notes as well. So thank you so much for that, Ian. I'm going to hand you over to Angelina.
I'm not going to pick a favourite of the Improvement Collaborative projects, because that's sort of like asking me to pick a favourite child. I very deliberately don't have any children, so I don't have to worry about things like that. I think the project that I'm working on, that I'm most proud of at the moment, without question, is the opt-out testing program. I mean, that is finding so many people, and we've been able to expand it in so many different ways that, again, it's kind of where you think about HIV as the lead, because, you know, opt-out testing has existed in some form or another for 20 years. In the UK, and there's been guidance that we should all do opt-out testing since at least 2012. And, you know, we had the Going Viral project in Bart, so, you know, we've got there are lots of different places that were already doing some form of opt-out testing in London. Probably 16 or 17 out of our 28 departments had at some point done some opt-out testing, and some of them were doing it routinely. But what we did, so opt-out testing, just for people who don't know what it is, you go to an emergency department for any reason and you're already having a blood test. So we will add, unless you specifically opt out, that's the opt-out bit of the program, big signs everywhere saying we're going to do this to you. So you can make an informed choice. But you will get a test that will test you for HIV and hepatitis B and hepatitis C. and that's a second vial. So, you know, when you get a blood test, you get a second vial of blood taken away. That second vial of blood will be sent to the lab. And then it's a no news is good news system. So if you don't get back, you can assume things are okay. If you're worried, you can still ring a number that we put on the posters to say, you know, here, you can order yourself a separate test if you want to. And the reason we do that is sometimes, you know, things go wrong in the, you know, in the transport stage of the sample, or we don't collect quite enough blood for the lab to be able to effectively do it. So there's always a backup mechanism. But by doing that, we add an enormous amount of capacity to our testing capability. So we were doing across the whole country about 2 million tests a year for HIV before this. And it's HIV testing week, actually, this week, isn't it? So it's a good time to talk about it as we record. So but by running this program in London, so we run it in 28, that's all of the London emergency departments. And then there's 6 other departments. So Manchester has 3, Salford, Blackpool and Brighton also have sites, so 34 sites in total. We've added 1 million tests a year, or slightly over 1 million tests a year. So you've got a 50% additional testing capacity, and you're testing people at random. They might be there for any reason. I mean, they're likely to be sicker than your normal people, but sorry, not normal people. There's nothing wrong with people in A&E. They just happen to be in an A&E. that sounds very wrong. Sorry, but they. They may be iller than standard, I guess. So we do those tests, we do it in A&E, and then you get a phone call if you have a reactive result for a confirmatory test. But that will be from the relevant department, so it'll be from hepatology or from the HIV department themselves. So what we don't do, crucially, is add a delay to the A&E process at all, and we're not holding anyone up. That process has found in the first 21 months 800 new diagnoses of HIV. And about 900 new diagnoses of hepatitis C and 2,500 hepatitis B cases. And on top of that, we found another 1,000 people who were at some point in care and have been lost to care. And so we've got the opportunity to re-engage them and offer them to come back into care. And we know that's as important. So there's all sorts of remarkable things that I've sort of just said there. Possibly the most remarkable was actually adding hepatitis. So we managed to do that because we have quite a visionary lead in HIV in hepatitis C, who runs a hepatitis C program for England called Mark Gillian Powell, who's a colleague of mine who I met, and literally within 10 minutes of meeting, we'd agreed to do HIV and hepatitis. So he'd effectively doubled the funding so we could find people. The hepatitis C can be fully cured now with a relatively simple set of drugs. So really genuinely transformative care, preventing lots of cancer and preventing HIV from getting any worse, and putting people onto treatment as soon as we can. So really, really remarkable, and remarkable to the point where the government has announced a new study over the next 2 years for the 47 sites that are in the next highest levels of prevalence. So that is the sites picked were picked because they're in areas of very high prevalence of HIV. The next sites picked are all of the sites in high prevalence areas. They've all got 1 year's funding. They can start from anytime from April, whenever they're ready, and they'll get a year's funding. And then we will, but we're not seeing a drop off in our pickup rates of viruses at the moment. So I'm sure there'll be continued pressure to continue the program after that. But that is the key, the key thing that will get us to zero is finding everyone who we know is sick. And there are other keys as well.
Yes.
But that number of diagnoses in it, when we're only really looking for 4,000 or 5,000 people. Now I know it's not the same people every year and people move around, but that's an enormous intervention, and adding the expanded sites, if we had everyone all running at once at the pace we want to, would turn that initial 2 million tests from 3 million with the original sites to 5 million. And then you think, well, if you can then do something in points of care testing around sexual health clinics, and that's a slightly different matter that you might pick up in a different podcast with someone, because that's a different funding route again, you can pretty much get to universal testing as a country, which would be a really interesting thing to do. And again, it shows what we can do by just tweaking the way we do diagnostics and not being afraid to just go, well, we do it because we did it like that yesterday, and going, well, actually, we shouldn't do it like that because we did it yesterday. We should do something else, or apply a little tweak to the process to see how it goes. So this is a very long answer, but it's worth it because the program is really quite remarkable. And I think in every single one of those sites, talking about how people can get involved, we have found champions that we didn't know we had. So I was really worried when we started that I went to see the emergency department physicians, and we had 14-hour waits for ambulances in car parks at A&E. And I thought, they're never going to go for this. There's never any way I'm going to be able to persuade anyone that they should run a program when you've got pressure like that within your emergency department. And I was really surprised because they turned around and said, you know what, no one ever really tells us what's happening to our patients. We know what, you know, we know we've discharged them, or we know we've admitted them, or they've gone home, or they might come back again. But no one tells us, because of a thing we did, these 20 people have got a diagnosis that's going to change their life. So if you can tell us that, we can, you know, absolutely we'll go for it. And again, so almost every department we've got, we have a sort of unofficial champion in the emergency department itself, but also you find, you know, the management within the trusts, the pathology departments, you know, the pathology is the majority of the expenditure everything relies on the pathology. And then the clinics being willing to take on that extra burden, which for HIV is less problematic than it is for hepatitis, especially with hepatitis B, because that number of new Hep B diagnoses is overwhelming our hepatitis system. So that, again, they're having to be dynamic and think about new ways to make sure people are appropriately triaged and people are cared for appropriately. But I know that we found people who already had Hep B that had turned into cancer and who were put on life-saving treatment immediately for that cancer and had, you know, would completely survive that. So because we were able to take a good idea, which was the idea of all of the HIV doctors, the HIV forum in London en masse, who said, this is really what they want to do. You know, if you can do, I asked them when I started working with them, what are the three things you want to do? And they gave me two. And one was they didn't want to be reconfigured, which is fine because we hadn't thought about doing that. So I could grant that one immediately. And the second one was we want to do opt-out testing. And they didn't come up with the third one. So I was like, oh, well, that's really good. I've got a really clear, coherent, clinical consensus about what they want to do, so let's see if we can do it. And all of these things have come out of that, and it's been it's an extraordinary journey. I work with some brilliant people. I work with Steve Hendel, I work with Dr. Rachel Hill Tout, you know, Matt Fagg in the prevention program, Jeff Featherston. But honestly, if I was to do credits for this program, it would take the rest of the record. There are hundreds of people involved in it, but hundreds of people involved in it because they can see what's happening. So it's genuinely been an utter joy.
Thank you very much. Really, honestly, it is an incredible project and an intervention indeed. So thank you so much for enabling that work to start and to begin and to actually continue. I'm going to move you just slightly off to a slightly different kind of project, but in a way which also just feeds into, you know, around addressing stigma and so many other things. So one of the small projects that you Fast Track Cities kindly supported is the Our Stories Told by Us, celebrating the African contribution to the HIV response book. Why did you agree to provide support towards the development as well as the recent launch of the book for leaders from the Black African community, or rather the Black community at the Africa Centre? Why did you agree to provide support towards it?
Well, it's because you're very hard to say no to, Angelina. I mean, that's kind of mostly why.
Exactly, yeah.
It wasn't a difficult decision. I mean, because, again, it goes to that whole heart of what, you know, who are we here for? You know, and we're here for, you know, everyone, and we do. We have a frankly, I think, a poor record of dealing with and being trusted by communities. I think there are lots of, we saw that in COVID. We saw, you know, we we saw that people have reasons not to trust the NHS in the way it works at the moment. And I know Fast Track Cities isn't the NHS, it's only one component part. So what is it we can do to earn the trust of the people that we work with and for? And this was, in the scheme of things, actually a really good idea that you and your friends and colleagues had come up with. So it really wasn't a difficult decision. Also, you asked Kevin to chair, and he's the chair of the Fast Track Cities group. So, that again, that made it a bit of an easier decision for us to make centrally. That was, of course, we're going to have to support it. But it was a great event. It was really lovely to be there and to see everyone and to hear your stories. And it's, again, it's so affecting and it's so real. And, the partnerships we have, the whole of Fast Track Cities for London is a partnership, and forging that partnership with you all is really important. So where we can help, we will help wherever we can.
Thank you very much. And thank you once again from me and the team.
It's just lovely listening to you speak so passionately about everything you've been involved in. And I think we share a lot of similar kind of passions. And one of the things that I also noticed and you mentioned in your introduction was that you're part of a trustee for Rethink Mental Health. And I was just wondering if you'd like to explain a little bit more of the work you do for our listeners.
Sure. So Rethink Mental Illness is the biggest charity in the country dealing with people who suffer from people who either suffer from or care for those with severe mental illness. So severe mental illness is the higher end of the mental illness spectrum. So people would recognise it as things like schizophrenia, borderline personality disorder, and so on. So people who have very, very difficult mental health conditions. Charity provides a range of services, but also does advocacy, so political advocacy, which we kind of is really, really important, and actually works. The mental health sector charities work really well together, and Rethink plays a kind of fairly central part in some of that as well. The role of the trustee is primarily to make sure the charity is an operating continuous concern, so you don't run out of money. But also to advocate for the people using the services, and it is linked to the HIV work. It's that the principles are the same. I get to go in and spend, a day every couple of months in a board meeting, just making sure that the governance of the charity is right, but also hearing about all the amazing things that happen through the charity's works. And also, get occasionally asked to do things like, go to Parliament and talk to some of the MPs or the, health ministers or so on, which again mirrors some of the work we do in HIV as well, around people's willingness to look at people living with severe mental illness as a priority group. And they are a priority group. They're in the Core 20 plus 5, which is the NHS equalities framework. And what's really interesting about the board at Rethink Mental Illness, and I always give it great credit for that, because again, I think the NHS could learn from it, is that we are half made up of people like me who are sort of co-opted professional trustees. We have the lawyers and accountants and people who serve the Department of Health, including our chair, Catherine. And half made up of people either who have severe mental illness themselves or their carers. And as a board, does not make decisions without the other. We make coherent decisions as a board. And so having it's basically a 50-50 split. So it's not like the professionals come in, not that the carers are not professionals as well, but it's not like the co-opted trustees come in and go, oh, we want to do things this way. Every single decision is balanced with a view of a care user or a carer. And I think that is something that we, again, miss a bit. So all of my work is really about trying to bring together those different aspects of the people who make decisions, the people who spend the money, and the people that will directly affect. So I get to do that for Rethink as well. And it's a really useful thing to do. So this is one of the better things that the NHS does, actually. NHS England certainly gives you 5 days off to do something else in your, as long as it's sort of in the public good. So I use my 5 days of sort of effectively paid leave to go and do something else to be on the board at Rethink. Now, obviously, probably spend a bit more than 5 days, that's fine. But the idea that the NHS allows you to do that is something that not enough people do. And I really encourage people to take up that offer wherever they can and go and do something a bit different in a sector you don't necessarily know as well, because I find it's really helpful. My real job is helpful for my job as a trustee, but also being a trustee is a really important bit of my shapes and my thinking for the work that I do in kind of my paid work, if that makes sense.
Thanks so much for sharing that with us. I'll definitely be looking into that in my own trust, so thank you. Just finally, the last question for me before I hand you back over to Angelina. One thing when we was preparing the book, Our Stories Told by Us, one of the questions that I enjoyed all the questions that our participants answered, but one of the things that kind of really resonated with us, and we thought we'd ask you this question, if you could go back in time to a younger version of yourself, is there any advice you would give?
I would probably try and find something earlier than I did. I'd try and find the HIV sector earlier than I managed to find it, and to start working in it sooner, because it took me quite a long time to find it. I was probably, 12, 13 years into my career before I realised that I could, partly that's because there was a stage at which I had enough kind of personal authority to go and do something like that. So it may not have worked out, but I think, and I would have certainly become a trustee sooner, and those are the main things for me. But also, actually, the other thing is maybe to work, find the value in the charity sector. So I've missed them out, but I'm going to credit them now. I became aware while we were speaking. So Deborah Gold at the National AIDS Trust, Richard Angel at the Terence Higgins Trust, and Ian Green before him, and Anne Aslett, especially at the Elton John AIDS Foundation. Yeah, working with them as the kind of larger charities in the sector who've really been able to push not only for what they wanted to happen, but work in a partnership way with each other, but also with me, that is really outstanding. So I would try and forge those partnerships really early, because what is definitely true is the combined advocacy of all of us is pretty awesome in terms of the power it has. So understanding that at an earlier point would be something that I would try and do, but there's nothing particularly I would change. I mean, there's probably a couple of things I probably wouldn't say yes to that I said yes to, but mostly you should say yes to stuff, I think.
Thank you very much. So we're coming towards the end of our podcast, and this part of the podcast is where our listeners get to know a little bit more about you. So I'm going to ask you just three very simple questions, and we'll see if we can get to know a little bit more. So the first question I'm going to ask you is, how can you share with our listeners something that you do as part of your self-care?
Yeah, I play golf a lot.
Okay.
as much as I can. It's, there's something about the simplicity of going into a field and hitting a little ball from here to over there that I find really quite mostly relaxing. It's not always relaxing, but also the company of my friends that I play golf with, it's my kind of primary sort of relaxation activity, I guess.
Thank you very much. And one of the things we like to do on the podcast is to recommend a book for our readers. So we ask all our guests to tell us if there's a book. So there's a book you're reading, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about it without putting in spoilers. So what book are you reading at the moment?
I'm not actively reading a book at the moment, which is quite embarrassing. I should be reading a book. So I'm going to recommend Small Gods by Terry Pratchett.
Okay.
Which it is an amazing book, actually, and is probably I probably goes towards my understanding of what religion better than any other. He articulates it far better than I ever could as a kind of as an atheist, atheist Jew, which is what I am. but Small Gods is the one I would definitely recommend to people to read. And actually, all of the Discworld books are incredible. 40 of them. But I read a book so bad recently it put me off reading for a bit. It was a sports autobiography. I won't say who it was for until after we finished recording. But it was I thought I'm just going to listen to podcasts instead now.
Okay, thank you very much. So the last one for me is the magic wand question. So if time, resources, and money weren't an issue, what would you like to change or to see done differently?
Well, in HIV, if time, resources, and money weren't an issue, we should eradicate it. So that's sort of relatively straightforward. In the world, I find it staggering that people are still hungry and shooting each other. I find it is sort of constantly baffled. I mean, I'm not baffled by it because people are greedy and horrible and base, which again is why I quite like, you know, working in this sector where people aren't like that. But I think there are, yeah, it's a bit of a Miss World answer, I know, but there are kind of so many things we could do better. But certainly in the UK, in England, I find it staggering that people are hungry. I just find it appalling, and I would change that first, probably.
Okay, thank you very much. So ending HIV and ending world hunger. I think those are good ones.
Thank you so much, Ian. So thank you, Ian, so much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure and privilege to spend and share this time with you. I could probably chat to you all night, but I'm mindful that we've got other things to do. So thank you so much for your time this evening.
You're very welcome, and thank you very much for inviting me. It's been lovely.
Thank you, yeah, and a huge special thank you to my co-host. We're living the dream this evening, so thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you for having me on, and thank you so much, Ian. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you to today's guest and to you for listening to this episode of HIV Matters. I don't know if you're anything like me and are busy writing down the lovely book suggestions made in our show. That's why HIV Matters have teamed up with bookshop.org to bring all these fantastic books to you in one unique place. To find out more about this and how to access the bookstore, please check out today's show descriptions. Today's edition of HIV Matters has been brought to you via an unrestricted educational grant from Vive Healthcare and Gilead Sciences. Gilead and Vive have had no input into guests or topics. HIV Matters is the official podcast of the National HIV Nurses Association. For more information about the National HIV Nurses Association, head over to www.nivna.org. Thanks again for listening to our show. We hope to see you next time, and together we can make a difference.